In one photograph after another, men wearing the international uniform of jeans stand like statues with mirrors in front of their faces. On the sandy beach next to rippling waves, on a boat out at sea, in front of an airplane carrying prayer rugs. Faceless men reflecting not themselves, but their surroundings. We don't really see them. We only see where they come from or where they're going. These photographs make up a new exhibit at the H&R Block Art Space, The Stranger's Notebook by artist Dewitt L. Petros. He's a Canadian artist who came to this continent as a refugee from Kenya. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Dewitt is on the line with us now. Good morning. Welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Good morning, Gina. Thank you for having me.
I saw your exhibition on Saturday, and the more I think about it, the more questions I have. It's a really good thing this interview isn't tomorrow, or we probably wouldn't have time for it. Have you gotten that response from a lot of people, that it's something that kind of seems simpler when you're looking at it and becomes more complex as you think about it?
My intention as an artist in this work and with all of my other projects has always been to construct work that remains with people, that you assume you're consuming on a simple visual level, but it remains with you and the questions burrow themselves into your psyche. And so I'm happy that it's had that effect on you. It's doing what it's intended to do.
So the questions that burrow themselves into your psyche, I mean, I could tell you what some of mine are, and we'll get to those, but what are the questions you're hoping will be burrowing into people's psyches?
I'm really interested in people unpacking questions of history, questions of boundaries, geography, culture. I want people to consider what it means to be a stranger. Who is the stranger? Is the stranger an external element, or is the stranger an internal condition that we carry within us? I'm interested in people repositioning contemporary movements, mobilities, and questioning them in light of larger histories, larger personal histories. So these are the types of questions that I'm hoping people think about.
We're going to get back to the art exhibit, but as long as we're putting them in the context of people's personal histories as well as larger international histories, why don't you tell us your own story?
Well, I come from a small country. I was born in a country called Eritrea in the midst of a difficult geopolitical set of conflicts that have a historical explanation within colonialism between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And we left in the midst of difficult circumstances and a very long route from Eritrea, Ethiopia, to Kenya, and then from Kenya to Canada.
When you say difficult circumstances, I really am sorry to do this because I know they might not be pleasant to recount, but could you be a little bit more specific?
Well, we left in the middle of a war. We left in the middle of the war, and the extent to which different family members were involved in the in the war of liberation, as Eritrea was attempting to secure its independence from Ethiopia, and so to a certain extent, everybody was at risk at this crucial moment in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so it was difficult circumstances. This is what I mean when I say difficult circumstances. Living in the midst of a war, living in the midst of a conflict, of a protracted conflict, where family members were participating in the struggle, were being killed in the struggle. And so for my parents and for my family, it really was a desire to give us an opportunity to live with a certain stability. So this is what led us through Ethiopia into Kenya and ultimately to Canada.
How did you travel? I mean, I think that for a lot of people who haven't had a refugee experience themselves, I mean, travel from one country to another, you board a plane or a train, and that's you do that with a ticket, sort of at liberty. What was your journey?
Our journey was a lot of it. We were privileged in that much of it we were sort of shielded. A lot of those early memories, up to 4 or 5, I don't really recall, to be perfectly honest with you. I recall it from the narratives of my, of my families. But it was. You see, there are things, Gina, that I'm comfortable discussing, and things that I'm not. But it's A lot of buses, a lot of living in places and then having to leave because we, as Eritreans, when we lived in Ethiopia, we could pass for Ethiopians, you see, and so it meant that my mother was extended periods of time in which my mother was was in prison while while we were with her as children, so it's yes. The difficulties, the difficulties of not being able to live within the context of your own country in peace. And it plays itself out in a lot of the narratives and stories that we see unfolding today.
So, as you began working on the art that's on display now in the Stranger's Notebook, what was your main idea? What was the project sort of on a practical level? I mean, what was it you set out to do?
On a practical level, I think I preface all of this by saying that I came to art from a desire to see experiences that mirrored what I was familiar with in one form or another. I always felt that there was an absence of the questions that I was thinking about, the way in which I was positioned in proximity to multiple cultures, the way I was positioned in proximity to multiple histories and narratives. So this is a concern that came with me into art and has never left. Now, specifically in regards to The Stranger's Notebook, one of the key points of research was time that I spent in Salina, Kansas, and this encounter with the remnants of an elephant bones at the Smoky Hill Museum. And this photograph of this, this photograph of the circus elephant that was killed in September 13th, 1920, in Salina, Kansas.
Okay, I'm
Interesting.
there's a lot actually to unpack here. First of all,
Yes.
whatever brought you to Salina, Kansas? I mean, I'm glad you came, but what brought you to this part of the country?
I came as I was invited as I was invited for an artist residency at the Salina Center for the Art. But I was fascinated by I was I'm fascinated by Kansas. I'm fascinated by that part of the world because it's a space that is familiar to me, having spent a significant part of my life growing up in Saskatchewan. So the landscape, the culture is something that is familiar to me. But secondly, I was really interested in the symbolic potential of a place near Salina called Osborne, Kansas, which is the geodetic center of the contiguous North American continent. And I found there was something really powerful, this powerful idea of traveling to the center of the United States, which many people perceive as this sort of, this peripheral space. But it was the inversion of traveling to the center, which is perceived as as a space that is peripheral. That was really interesting to me. So I went to make art lured by these ideas.
Very big ideas, but you came and found your inspiration in an elephant. So
In an elephant, yes.
pick back up with that. There's this circus elephant that had been killed in what year?
In 1920, September 13th, 1920.
Why was the elephant killed?
Well, the elephant came to Salina, Kansas, as part of circus. Is an elephant that was performed by a really interesting historical figure lady by the name of Lucia Zora. And I asked for a tour of the museum and specifically the holdings underneath the storage spaces and saw what I thought was an elephant tusk, but it ended up being parts of, I believe, elephant ribs and the jaw of this elephant. And from there unravels this incredible tale of this story of this elephant that came with the circus, ended up marauding through town once Lucia, his regular performer, had left the circus. And this elephant, so then it was killed, and was killed by local militiamen, but not before it had destroyed a significant portion of Salina, Kansas. And I was really fascinated by a photograph that was produced of the event, which is the carcass of Snyder the elephant with the militiamen on top of them, and the other members of town sort of gathered around this body. And it was an image that I thought was so complex in terms of how it positioned questions of the stranger, how it complicated questions of the periphery.
Wait, how does it do that?
Well, what was fascinating for me was, in addition to the photograph I saw, I was looking at eyewitness accounts, historical retellings of the event, and everybody misread this elephant and assumed that it was an African elephant. And so onto this, the elephant became the cipher for the projection of all of the worst sort of racist fantasies and deepest, darkest fantasies about the African continent play out on the body of this elephant, which is actually an elephant from India that was born in captivity in Berlin in Germany before coming to the United States. And so here is this being that is fundamentally misread, that comes to a location, Salina, Kansas, that is perceived as being a peripheral space, but is actually central. And here you have this, you know, this elephant that is perceived as coming from one periphery, but is actually coming from this other space. And so within that nexus of, you know, within this sort of complex nexus was this really powerful allegory that I felt was really relevant in terms of giving me an understanding of who is moving at what moment in history and how are these stories being told or not being told. And so that event became the catalyst for me looking at other figures. So Snyder led me to an Aboriginal historical reenactor, also turn of the century, 1910-20s, called Esther Deer, who participated in, you know, the Wild Bill Hickok type shows, and she traveled all across Europe, North America, and also South Africa. And then that research led me to an Abyssinian, what we now call an Ethiopian writer, who traveled from Ethiopia, Abyssinia, to Italy in 1890, spent 5 years there, and wrote a text, the first biography, the first autobiography and journal travelogue in my language, called About the Author's Journey. And so The Stranger's Notebook is really, even though it ends up being hinged on the last text that I'm telling you, is really embedded within the trajectory of these three historical figures whose stories complicate the narratives of who is moving historically and under what circumstances.
So I just want to say that looking at the art, you don't see visually any of what you just described. You don't see an elephant, and you very much don't see Kansas. I mean, because as you've said, Kansas is sort of snugly in the center of this great big piece of land, as far as you can get from an international border, whereas most of the locations that you're talking about are right on these borders in places where you can't not see it, or in front of a mode of transportation, or even on a mode of transportation. The idea of being sort of snugly in the center is not part of these images. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious about that distinction. I mean, can you talk a little bit? We've heard what inspired you. Can you tell about what you actually did for this exhibit, how you created the art, where you went, what you were doing?
Yes. I think the only thing that I would say to you, I think art has a way of the narratives that I'm describing to you, Gina, are, they may not be explicit, but they provide the logic through which I move through space. They provide the logic through which the work comes together, so that what are the things that are visible? What are the things that are not invisible, that are not visible, or something that is of profound significance to me? But in terms of how it informs the work, so what I did to make the work was, I took this, you know, I took these figures and specifically the author's journey as my guide as I moved from Nigeria all the way west through West Africa, North Africa, and into Western Europe. So in 2014, I embarked on a 13-month journey across these three countries, and I moved from Nigeria through Senegal, Mauritania to Spain, France to Italy. And so, while I'm moving through these spaces, I'm encountering different communities, different individuals, but I'm really thinking about situating my own contemporary movement and mobility through these often contested and complex spaces within a very expansive frame of social and political histories. And so part of it was splitting up the work into distinct sections. And so, for example, when I was traveling from Nigeria to Senegal, I ended up making a series of sound works. I ended up making a filmic work. I ended up making a series of photographic works. And if I could talk to you specifically about one piece, there's a piece in the shop, in the film, in the exhibition called The Shop, which is this film moving image work, very fragmented, very abstract, in which a shrouded figure is at work in a sewing, engaged in labor of he's a tailor.
You know, and the sewing machine makes a noise that
sounds like the film projector.
Yeah, it does.
Yes. Yeah. So this is what I mean when I say complicating history. So what that piece is doing is the staging of that piece was first in a place called in Bamako. And what I did was I took the white van that we were traveling through and projected the film that is being a variation of the film that is on display. But in that context, the way in which I was staging a public cinema, the way in which the community in that environment, the community of Bamako gathers around this nighttime scene and watches this film. The history of that is not Western cinema. The history of that is the rise of cinema in Nigeria, in which cinema arose in these kinds of contexts, in which people would gather around a cinema van, Majigi van, the projector would go up, the sound, you know, the speakers would go out, and film would be projected. So part of why I was using this narrative of history for cinema in that context was to talk about, to talk specifically about that figure in the film, Michael, who's a young tailor from Benin and who works and lives between Benin and Nigeria. So in that section, for example, Gina, part of what I'm interested in is complicating the idea that all Africans are trying to move out of Africa, that everybody in the South is trying to move north. And so that film uses a very opaque strategy, shrouds the figure, the labor, and makes us think about cinema, makes us think about the condition of, you know, the condition of the cinematic, so that we can think about narratives and stories that are in the shadows of globalization, but they're also in the shadows of a certain form, both of history, but and also of migration.
Well, yeah, it seems like it's partly about not just the story that is true about the person, but also how we learn these stories. I mean, that's part of what film is. It's a medium. It's part of the media, if you will. And I'm curious, I mean, for you personally, and just in terms of what you saw on this long journey you took, where you met so many other people who are moving from one place to another and in transit, either on a small scale taking a trip or on a large scale migrating from one place to another, are the assumptions that people make about those journeys and the stories people tell themselves about you as much a part of your experience as what you've actually been through? I mean, that seems like something you just have to reckon with in this world is what people think has happened.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the things that one confronts when you're moving through these spaces is the absolute disjuncture between the extent to which these narratives are marshaled in dominant media stories versus the complexity of the realities. And people are moving for a myriad reasons. People are moving in multiple directions, and there's a way in which there is no singular overarching narrative in which these kinds of different reasons to move can be reduced into a simple everybody's moving for reason A or everybody's moving for reason B. And part of the ultimate stranger that I'm dealing with all of this is me, right? I mean, it really is thinking about my own location and dislocation through these various contexts and through these histories that have a radically diverged, that have a very different way of unfolding when I think about them in terms of how I've moved out of, you know, how the earlier narrative that I discussed with you before.
Right.
And secondly, I think part of what is important for me in terms of when we look towards the sort of third part of the work, which unpacks
We're going to talk about that when we come back. But KCUR's Central Standard has to take a break. We're going to get right back to Dawit El Petros on KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm here with artist Dawit El Petros, who was just telling us the story of himself as the stranger. His art exhibit, The Stranger's Notebook, is on view now at the H&R Block Art Space just off Main Street near Westport. And Dawit was just saying that he himself is really the stranger in that work. You wanted to tell us about a part of the exhibit that really zeroes in on that idea of yourself as the stranger.
Right. Yeah. It's when we look at the third section of the work, which really unpacks the two-way historical emigration from Italy. It's opening up my own understanding of my colonial inheritance and understanding the earlier. There are two waves of Eritreans who leave. The first is my family, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the second are those who are now leaving through Libya, traversing the dangers of the Mediterranean. And part of what was difficult for me was to think about how these are events that are connected historically. And so it was me encountering my own estrangement from these histories that continue to talk about how the entanglement of Italy, Eritrea, Ethiopia, how the entanglement of Europe itself and the East Africa and the countries of the East Africa are deeply integrated into what is happening within these contemporary events. And so part of my strangeness was my inability, or my distance from how these historical events play out.
I like that you just said strangeness and not strangeness.
Mm, yes, because I was saying earlier that I'm interested in a familiarity. There's this notion that of an intimate stranger. That's where we're not. This isn't about sugarcoating estrangement or non-familiarity, but it's a recognition of how we within the context of our own being, wherever we are, if we can recognize that inherently we are always dislocated by being located, then that becomes, I think, a place from which we can have a certain politics of compassion. So this is why I use the
position. So like your location is that you are sort of unhinged from a certain geographical spot, that you're a person who's been uprooted or moved around. That's your real geography?
Absolutely. But what I'm hoping to do, Gina, is I'm interested in proposing that not just within the context of the biography that I've just described, so that I'm bringing that conversation into Kansas City, so that somebody who's, three, four, five generations born and raised in that space can also begin to find within strangeness a place for themselves.
I guess I had assumed, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but to see works that deal with the relationship between Europe and Africa, and especially the images from Tangier, where there's this part of the wall that surrounds the walled city. There's this part where that wall's broken, and you have people standing there, and you can see out across the Mediterranean. You can see the shores of Spain. It's hard for me to see an image like that in a show with the word "the stranger" in it and not jump to the classic work of French existentialist literature, The Stranger by Albert Camus from the colonial period set in Africa? Is there a reference to that or no?
There is, but I think my deployment of stranger is more deeply rooted in George Simmel, the German sociologist, who talks about the stranger as a, you know, as the figure who comes today, who comes today and leaves who leaves today and comes tomorrow. This idea of there's a way in which Simmel proposes the stranger as a position that can, you know, that offers a fundamental sort of disjointedness that can allow a culture or a space to, you know, to understand its way in a truly meaningful way, so that it isn't this thing that is feared, but it's a position or a perspective that is necessary for a particular space to truly understand itself in a meaningful way. So it is more rooted in Simmel than it is in Camus.
That being said, can I read you a little quote from The Stranger that really struck me as interesting, thinking about your art? It's, "Mostly I could tell I made him uncomfortable. He didn't understand me, and he was sort of holding it against me. I felt the urge to reassure him that I was like everybody else, just like everybody else. But there really wasn't much point, and I gave up the idea."
This is Camus.
Yeah.
Yes, but you see, I'm inclined to Simmel's deployment of it, because I think part of what I would like to unpack is the idea that the stranger is somebody who perpetually, like, I think there's a way in which we're all leaving and coming, regardless of how conditioned we are within the context of one particular space. And so part of what I'm interested in is the extent to which, if it becomes something that I carry within me, then it encounters the stranger outside of me in a different way.
Talk to me more about that image or those images from Tangier that seem to me in some ways to be more images of Spain, actually.
The images that you're talking about, that section is the portion that really deals with the movement from Mauritania to Spain. And what I was interested in that series of photographs is the way in which that body of water, the Mediterranean, has historically been transformed from a place of cultural exchange into this impenetrable, you know, cultural or ideological barrier between Europe and Africa itself. And so prior to the formation of the European Union, Moroccans could travel into Spain without a visa. And so there are these historical events that shut down that two-way traffic, and it's transformed into a one-way space of journey. And so those photographs that you're talking about, in which the wall is partially broken, it was only broken for a few days before it was reconstituted, the images in which you see these fabrics that are suspended, these are all...
Yeah, blue. They look almost like flags, but without any symbols on them, just blue or green.
Yes, they look like flags, but they look like script that is this calligraphic script that is punctuating space. But all of those things are looking out, but they're also looking in, and so there are the confrontation, the image of the confrontation where you have the groups of men that are arguing over the space, the figure with his back to Europe. There, the perspective looks both ways. So there are historical events that are being referenced that are, Morocco's takeover of the Western Sahara, for example. These are historical events that happen because of Europe's participation, but the perspective doesn't only look one way. It really does look in multiple directions.
Is that personal for you? I mean, we're talking about such abstract ideas and such really global history.
Mm-hmm.
How is that personal for you?
Well, it's deeply personal in that I studied history before I moved into art, and so I'm always interested in finding alternatives within history through which one can argue for alternatives within the present and, you know, and alternatives in the future. So it does come from this personal space, but I also think that it comes from a concern with these much larger global historical geopolitics that you're talking about. So the writing of history this is a deeply personal and significant terrain to, you know, to wage struggle in.
Yeah. Dawit El-Petros, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Gina.
The Stranger's Notebook is on display at the H&R Block Art Space. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. When you think sexual revolution, you're probably thinking 1960s, maybe 1970s, right? Well, go back a little further. Around the turn of the 20th century, women were already starting to show a little bit of ankle, even going so far as to display their legs up to the calves. It's a fascinating story and really a very serious one. A KU professor of history and sociology is here to tell us about the sex trials of the early 1900s and the portrait they paint of a sexual revolution. Brian Donovan, good morning.
Good morning.
So talk to me about what specifically intrigued you here. You're looking at something called the sex trials of the early 1900s. I admit, never even heard of them before.
Well, I looked at a set of criminal trials that occurred in the early 20th century that are housed at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And these trials are fascinating because they're verbatim trials. So reading them, you feel like you are in the courtroom. And I believe they capture a unique picture of early 20th century America.
Who's on trial for what?
These are seduction trials, first-degree rape trials, compulsory prostitution, or what we would now call trafficking trials, and trials for men accused of sodomy.
Okay, so lots of trials for people accused of various things, all kind of coming back in some way or another to sex. So you're looking through the transcripts of these trials and photographs of them too, right?
No photographs, actually.
Oh, okay.
An interesting aspect of these trials is that although a lot of attention has been paid to the more popular trials of the era, these are trials of regular, ordinary New Yorkers, and so the newspaper and photographic evidence just simply isn't there. These trials are the only records of their experiences, which is why I think they're so important.
So what is it about them that made you think you were reading sort of primary documents that together painted a picture of a sexual revolution in that time period?
Well, I think they speak to both the first sexual revolution, where you see evidence of women breaking out of the Victorian norms that constrained them for the 19th century. You see evidence of young men and women going to dance halls, to movie theaters, going out drinking, enjoying the new amusements that were popping up all over the place in New York City. But you also see a kind of downside to the sexual revolution. So the very things that we consider hallmarks of this first sexual revolution, movie theaters, automobiles, new amusements, were also new sites of sexual coercion.
Wait, how were the movie theaters and automobiles? Explain that
sure.
A little more.
Sure. Well, this is really nicely explained by research from KU historian Beth Bailey in her book From a Front Porch to Back Seat, where she talks about the rise of dating in the early 20th century. And she writes about these new urban sites where dating can take place. What my research shows is that these new urban spaces were also areas where men could coerce sex out of women. So there are a few cases in the trials that I look at of so-called white slave procurers picking up women in darkened movie theaters and promising them employment and then essentially coercing them into prostitution. And automobiles become also a site of sexual revolution and counter-revolution. Sexual revolution in the sense that these this new form of transportation can take young men and women to these new spots in the city, but also it's a space where men can coerce women.
What? So, okay, there's the dark side of all of this is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about just what distinguishes this particular sexual revolution from the one that people are a little more familiar with?
Sure. I think that we see in this era the beginnings of sexual agency, sexual expression, that we tend to look maybe back in the 1940s and 50s, and we think of the 50s as, you know, this kind of repressed time period. But if we look back in the early 20th century, around 1900 to 1920, we start to see the emergence of what would later be known as flapper culture. So women are, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, they're dressing in a little more of a risque way. They're going out on dates, which was, again, a new thing at that time. Also, they have money to spend. The female employment rate quadruples from about 1880 to 1920. And so women have, young women have money in their pocket. There are new ways to spend that money. And we start to see a new kind of self-confidence and a kind of shucking off of Victorianism.
Tell me something specific you saw in one of these trial transcripts that led you to some of these conclusions.
And we also see the emergence of new sexual subcultures. One set of cases I look at are of men accused of sodomy in a bathhouse in New York City.
So, talk to me about, you know, just something that is captured, some slice of life that is captured in one of these trial transcripts that...
Hello.
Oh, okay. It sounds like maybe we are having some difficulty connecting with our guests. Let me just quickly try this again. Can you hear us, Brian Donovan?
I can hear you, yes. Sorry.
Okay. So tell me about something specific in one of these trial transcripts that gives you the picture that you're painting. I mean, what is it specifically that you read in one of these documents this vision into the past?
Sure. In one of the cases, this is a case of sodomy. A young woman named Sadie Marza was dating a man named Morris Hansman. And sodomy wasn't, or not sodomy, I'm sorry, seduction. Seduction was an interesting category where it's a situation where a man promises to marry a woman, and then she sleeps with him upon that promise, and then he goes back on that promise and refuses to marry her. And in the case of Sadie Marza and Morris Hansman, he was accused of seduction. And so she set up with the police a kind of sting operation in order to basically trap him in this situation. And so they arrested Morris Hansman for seduction, and you could see
seduction seems like an awfully polite word for what you're describing, though.
It is, and seduction had two roles in the early 20th century. The seduction law was a way to essentially prod men like Morris Hansman into marrying a woman that they slept with, whose reputation would be ruined because of that so-called unchastity. But also the trials that I looked at, the seduction trials I looked at, often show evidence of sexual coercion, what we would now call date rape or acquaintance rape. Yet the standards for first-degree rape during this time are so high that prosecutors in these scenarios probably couldn't gain a successful prosecution, so they charged the men with seduction. So I suggest that seduction is this odd category where it kind of harkens back to the Victorian era, but also seduction prosecutions are recognizing this new form of sexual coercion that would, in the 1970s, be called date rape or acquaintance rape.
So, I mean, and the desirable result of these trials is for the women who are in what we would today say, you know, victims, or, you know, at some point you might call them survivors, but yes. Certainly today, you know, you don't see people wanting the desirable outcome to be that this man will marry her.
Right. That's very true. And it also speaks to, I think, a sense of how far we've come with recognizing sexual assault and the problem of it. And most seduction laws were struck down by 1930. So there was this growing recognition that these laws were had these kind of outdated assumptions baked into them.
So when we talk, I mean, hearing the phrase sexual revolution, it seems that's a phrase that kind of hints at a freeing of someone or something. But nothing you've described sounds especially liberating to me, I'll be honest.
Right. That's, I think, a main argument of my book, that historians have too often touted and celebrated the kind of liberatory aspects of this time period. And we look to images or people like, you know, Clara Bow or Theda Bara, and we see this
stars of the silent screen.
Exactly. And we see this new sexual expression, this new forwardness, and we see progress in the sense of casting off the Victorian era. And what I want to suggest by looking at these criminal trials is that there was also an element of that there was a dark side to this sexual revolution, that it wasn't all flappers and dance halls.
So, I mean, we've heard about the dark side. What is the less dark side?
Well, I think the less dark side, if we look at sodomy trials, we could see in one of the set of cases I look at, focus on the Ariston bathhouse. And the Ariston bathhouse was a place that in 1903, men would gather together and they would have anonymous sex. And here you can see the growth of a subculture of men who we would now classify as gay. And this, I think, gets lost in discussions of gay liberation, because we tend to look at, say, you know, the Stonewall riots as the birth of gay liberation. In the Ariston bathhouse cases, we could see men who were very comfortable in their sexuality and meeting other men, and essentially having a good time.
So is there an exchange in one of these trials that really fascinated you, that you just really, like, you couldn't believe what you were reading?
There were a couple moments. There was one trial of a woman accused of so-called white slavery or compulsory prostitution, a mixed-race woman named Belle Moore. And she was accused of trafficking two young teenage girls and selling them to a brothel in Alaska. And what was shocking to me, this was one of the only trials that garnered any kind of press attention. In the New York City newspapers, it was touted that she was trafficking in these two teenage girls, and that possibly she was responsible for the death of a 12-year-old girl named Helen Hastings. During the trial, the two trafficked victims testified, and they were clearly not the coerced young teenagers that the press made them out to be. They were in their 20s. They had been practicing prostitution for quite a while. They calmly discussed the transaction with Belle Moore. Their demeanor and the story they told flew in the face of the kind of archetypal white slavery narrative of the early 20th century. That was shocking. Also, in a seduction case, I've mentioned this before, Sadie Marza, who was trying to get Morris Hansman to marry her, one of the standards in these seduction cases and also in first-degree rape cases was that the woman had to physically resist her attacker. And so the attorney was trying to get Sadie to talk about how she physically resisted Morris Handsman. And she said, you know, and the attorney asked, did you fight back? Did you kick? Did you scratch? And she
said, how does it all end?
He is found guilty of seduction. And she threw back the question at the attorney and said, you know, what do you mean? Did I scratch? Do you think I'm a cat? And in that moment, she's expressing this kind of assertiveness that we wouldn't necessarily think a seduced victim would have.
Brian Donovan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now, before we go, the Jorge Arana Trio is a Kansas City-based instrumental rock band featuring a guitar, bass, drums, and synth keyboard. Their music is experimental with a heavy sound, but the latest album, Mammoth, is different.
It's kind of my first foray into really trying to write with the sound itself in mind, as opposed to always concentrating on the rhythms and notes.
As he was writing the music, guitarist Jorge Arana tried to give sounds and rhythms more space. In the process, he tapped into something deeply personal lurking in the music. For this installment of Story of a Song, we're focusing on two songs that brought monsters to life for their creator.
It started just with a very simple riff that reminds me of something, maybe like an old kung fu movie or western or something like that kind of opening scene. Loops and it builds and slows down, and I've never really written that kind of style before. Usually I always write songs that are very jam-packed with info and notes and rhythms. I was a big video game fan since I was a little kid. So all that music is, you know, it's based on constraints, so it's all 1-2 minute loops. I've made it concerts effort since I was young to like fight instincts, like instead of playing things based on a key, it'd be more like on shapes, geometry. You know, I like the clash of the random notes and the gnarly dissonances. Like this album has a lot of closely spaced bass notes playing at the same time. With Speak Beast, I'm trying to use the guitar as some sort of monster trying to say something. I was trying to be expressive with like a downshifted, fuzzed out guitar, which some people might say it's muddy. I like to say it's murky, just dark, it's moody. It makes me think of something like a mammoth. That's the monster there. it's definitely like moaning and groaning and angry at something. It reminds me of an old nightmare I had when I was a kid. Walking around the street, looking up to the sky, and I see a giant meteor or something just getting close to the earth, and it's like, whoa, what's that? Then it gets closer and closer, and I'm like, oh, it's hot, I'm burning. It's like, oh man, I'm not gonna outrun that. So I'm just looking at it. And then it gets unbearable to wake up.
We're listening to is Speak Beast by the Jorge Arana Trio. This story of a song was produced by KCUR's Andrea Ted Hope. And that's a wrap for today's show. You can listen to any of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also talk to us on Twitter whenever you want. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. We get help from our interns, Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.